Welcome to the Southern Voice Rock Show. Here's your host, Jim Harris.
We're really excited about today's episode. With us is Alan Paul, and Alan has written two New York Times rock and roll bestsellers about Stevie Ray Vaughan and the Allman Brothers. And he's about to release a new book called Brothers and Sisters that's about the creation of the Allman Brothers' best-selling album and their relationship with Grateful Dead, their performance at Watkins Glen, and a lot of good inside information. So if you're an Allman Brothers fan, you're going to want to stay tuned for that. Also with us today, original 38 special member, guitarist, songwriter extraordinaire, Jeff Carlisi. So we've got an exciting show, and let's get started. All right, Alan Paul, welcome to the Southern Voice Rock Show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
There is so much buzz going on about your new book, about the creation of the legendary album, Allman Brothers, Brothers and Sisters. It's in every media outlet, and I just noticed that it's the cover story on this month's Guitar Player. So congratulations on all the interest that's going on in advance of your release.
Thank you very much. You know, writing a book can be a very isolating, lonely pursuit. You know, you're sitting in libraries of research and in a little office at home, and you just hope that when you finish it, you come up with something that resonates with people. And I felt as I was writing it, I was getting more and more excited about where it was headed and that I was doing that. You never know until, you know, the moment of truth. So it is very satisfying and exciting, and appreciate your interest and everyone else's.
Well, given that this is your third book that music-oriented, One Way Out, about the Allman Brothers, Texas Flood, about Stevie Ray Vaughan, and this being your second Allman Brothers book, it's very evident that you are an Allman Brothers fan. How did that happen? What led you to become an Allman Brothers fan and a super fan?
Well, I'm just exploring that myself. I'm trying to work through that. I'm writing an essay about that. I grew up in Pittsburgh, not the South, as you know, but you know, Pittsburgh had a very strong Southern rock presence. I mean, Leonard Skinner, eventually, once I started getting into the business, I met one of the Leonard Skinner's managers after they'd reformed in the early 90s, who told me Pittsburgh was always one of their top, I think he said, three or five markets, which was enlightening to me. I wasn't quite aware of that when I was getting into this music as a kid, I was sort of normal for my region. It didn't always feel that way. I date it back to my brother, who's 4.5 years older than me. At some point when I was about 12, he handed me a copy of Eat a Peach and said, listen to this. And I thank him for that. I mean, in the 70s, as a lot of your listeners, I think, will remember and resonate, a big brother just allowing you to listen to his stereo was a big deal. You know, he gave me open access to his record collection and his stereo, and I thank him for that. And that's why I dedicated One Way Out to him. So he's the one who got me started, but why it resonated with me so much is something I've thought about a lot, and I don't exactly have an answer for. It just did. When I was in eighth grade, we had in social studies class an assignment to write an essay about a great American. People were writing about Thomas Edison and Abraham Lincoln and George Washington and being Pittsburgh, Mean Joe Green and Terry Bradshaw and Roberto Clemente. And I wrote about Dwayne Allman. And I wish I could go back and interview 12 or 13-year-old me and ask why I chose Dwayne Allman. I'm not exactly sure, but I did. It always resonated with me. I fell in love with the music. I fell in love with the mythology. When I became a professional journalist, I had the opportunity to start interviewing these guys and exploring it. And I just got deeper and deeper. And the transition from being a fan and a regular journalist interviewing the guys and writing books to being more of an insider with the access that allowed me to write these books really came about through my relationship with Kirk West, who was the band's tour mystic, which was his title because he was the tour manager, but he did so much more than the regular tour manager that he had to have a special name. He and I developed a friendship and a relationship based on our mutual love of music and his decision that, you know, he liked my work and that I was worth supporting. He's the one who brought me around, sort of having me backstage and helped me get to the next level.
Well, that leads me into my next question. And early in the book, actually on the opening of the book, you mentioned that a lot of the research came from a collection of tapes that you actually got from him after the book was underway. But when you started the book, were you aware that these tapes existed?
One Way Out was based completely on my own interviews. It's an oral history. Every quote you see in that book came from an interview I conducted, unless otherwise noted. You know, it might say so-and-so told Rolling Stone, but there's very little of that. The one exception was Red Dog, the legendary Allman Brothers road crew member, who I knew quite well, spent a lot of time talking to backstage at shows and had a nice relationship with, but stupidly never interviewed and never formally turned on a tape recorder and interviewed him. And when I started to write One Way Out, he had passed away, and I realized it was so stupid. I can't believe I don't have Red Dog. So I talked to Kurt, and he gave me his Red Dog tapes. So I was well aware of them. I did use them in a limited form in One Way Out. When I started writing this book, Kirk offered me his tapes. He had done tons of interviews, I mean, countless hours of interviews with the members of the Allman Brothers Band in the mid-80s when they were broken up for what was to be a book project that he abandoned in 1989 when they reformed and he became an employee of the band. So his tapes sort of sat in a two-sided suitcase in his office for, geez, you know, decades and decades, most of which he had never even listened to. And then he offered them to me, and it was incredible. I mean, I was writing the book anyhow, and I was already onto some pretty cool stuff, and I felt confident I could do something unique. What he did by giving me those tapes amped it up, I mean, by a lot. It's hard to even overestimate or explain the treasure trove of what was in these cassettes.
So that our listeners will have an idea of kind of the deep dive that exists in the book, one of my favorite parts was about the recording of the song Ramblin' Man for the album and all the twists and turns that happened with that. I think it's an interesting aside that song was almost passed along to another band or artist, kind of like Marshall Tucker's Fire on the Mountain was originally submitted to Charlie Daniels, and they only recorded it after he turned it down. And, you know, that seems to be fairly common in Southern rock, but as it turns out, obviously it was a great turn of events that the Allman Brothers ended up recording it themselves.
That's right. Well, it's a little bit controversial. So I tried in this book to break down some myths and various legends about a lot of things. And that was one of them. So in later years, I think things got really tense between Dickie and the other members of the Allman Brothers, and they parted ways in 2000. And Butch Trucks would spend a lot of time talking about how he never liked Ramblin' Man. And when they recorded it, they thought it was going to be a demo that they were going to send to Hank Williams Jr. or Merle Haggard. That was what Butch always said. Dickie himself always said that he thought the song was too country and that he was doing that. But what I found digging into it is that that's not 100% true. It is certainly accurate that Dickie felt that it was too country for the band to record. And he was thinking of recording a demo and sending it off. That's not unprecedented. I mean, Dickie did write for other people, and other people recorded his songs. He wrote the song "Ain't Gonna Call Hank Williams Jr. Jr. Anymore" for David Allan Coe, for instance. But when they actually cut "Ramblin' Man," from what everything I can gather once I really dug into it, everyone in the studio knew they had recorded something really great. And so, although I do think the initial thought, and it was mostly from Dickie. This is what I really learned in writing it, is that Dickie is the one who thought it was too country and that they should record it as a demo to show to other artists. But once he played it for the band, they all said, oh, no, it's a great song. Let's cut it. I guess it's possible that if it hadn't turned out the way it turned out and as strong as it was, maybe it would have been passed on. But once the actual song was recorded, I don't think there was ever any question about it being included. And, you know, sometimes things get lost in the fog of time. Even over the years, Dickie has often said, well, I thought the song was too country, but we needed one more song to finish the album. And that also is just not accurate because it was the second song they recorded. And there's no doubt about that, because it's one of only two songs that bassist Barry Oakley is on before he tragically passed away.
That's a perfect example of the kind of information that your reader is going to find in Brothers and Sisters. In that segment of the book where you get into the recording of Rambling Man, you also mentioned that in the early days of the band, before their tragic losses, Barry Oakley and Duane Allman were essentially the leaders of the band.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Duane was unquestionably the leader of the band. Nobody doubted that. They would often say there was no leader to the band. We were all equals. And there's truth in that, in the sense that there wasn't a leader in the band the way, you know, Miles Davis was the band leader, or Elton John is the band leader, and everyone else is the support. Certainly was not the case. But they were a band of equals following a leader, if that makes any sense. And Duane was the leader. He never had to say he was the leader. He never had to tell people to follow him. It was just sort of unquestioned. Barry was what I call the colonel to Duane's general. And as J-Mo would say, the great drummer, who was the first employee, the first member of the band that Duane enlisted, J-Mo said it to me like this: Duane was so intense that nobody could talk about him anything. And sometimes people had a hard time dealing with him because he was so hard charging. He didn't have time or care for diplomacy. And Barry was a little more manageable. Barry would take Duane's ideas and orders and go to people and say, "Hey, man, I think we ought to do this or that." He could make things a little more palatable and was sort of easier to deal with, had better people skills, I guess you could say. So they had a system amongst the two of them that really, really worked well together. And they were the undisputed leaders. Everybody else followed along. It doesn't mean that they didn't have their own ideas or have disagreements or argue about things or hammer things out. But those were the two guys that everyone followed. And when they were suddenly gone, unfortunately and tragically quite abruptly, there was a real void there. And that's part of what, you know, I'm exploring.
It seems that you get into the passing of the torch, so to speak, to Greg and Dickey, and how that situation impacted this album as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting and essential things to understand and that I try to illuminate here is that neither of them were really suited to be leaders. And I just mean in the sense that Greg was a little bit too passive. He tended to do things to keep to himself. He wasn't someone who liked to give orders or worry about what other people were doing so much. And Dickey also had a little bit of a tendency to go within himself. A lot of the people found him inscrutable, a lot of the band members, and hard to deal with. Whenever he would go into sort of dark spells and be sort of going down a little bit of a hole, Duane was the one who would always come and say, "Hey, buddy, what's going on? Let's go. What's wrong? Come on, let's go pick it up." He was the one who could put his arm around Dickey and make everything okay. So when Duane was gone, Dickey would sometimes go into these dark, silent spells, and nobody really knew quite how to deal with it. So neither of them were really suited to be leaders, and yet somehow they managed to pull it off and not only survive and continue, but to have their most commercially successful and sort of culturally relevant period. That part of it is sort of an extraordinary story and part of what I wanted to really explore in this book.
A couple of other things that you cover in great detail is the band's connection to the Grateful Dead and the influence there. The massive show at Watkins Glen, which I think was probably, 600,000 people or so?
Yeah.
There's a lot of different aspects of the Allman Brothers in this time frame that you cover. But one that I really want to touch on today is the subsequent tour and the impact of that on Cameron Crowe's 2000 film, Almost Famous.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. You hit a lot of good high points there in my book. The relationship with the Grateful Dead, I thought, was something that had been really underexplored. So I was happy to do that. I anticipated that being a chapter. It became two chapters. Watkins Glen, I thought, also was a bit underexplored. I expected that to be a chapter. It became two chapters. So there was so much of interest there. I really enjoyed digging into that. And that certainly applies as well to Cameron Crowe. I was also very blessed that as I began the process and I reached out to Cameron Crowe, we had some conversations. He became convinced that I was approaching this in the right way, and he was very cooperative, which was, of course, essential in telling the story. And the bottom line is that Almost Famous is almost 100% based on his experience with the Allman Brothers Band in 1973. It doesn't mean that each band member in the fictional Stillwater relates to a band member in the Allman Brothers. They were a bit of a composite. But the inspiration for what happened was really his experience with the Allman Brothers Band. And Cameron went through it with me in vivid detail. Suffice it to say that what happened with him was that instead of the artist in the end denying that the quotes were real, which is what he made it in Almost Famous, Greg just made it a step easier for himself. He had Red Dog, the aforementioned legendary roadie, confiscate Cameron's tapes. And so he went in a day from the high of writing his first Rolling Stone cover story at the age of 16, by the way, having an incredible interview, which was the first time Greg had ever really talked about Dwayne's death and what it meant to him and the impact on him personally and on the band. Just this incredible piece of journalism. He went from that to possibly having nothing. I mean, his tapes, which were not just his interview with Greg, but all of his interviews that he had been doing for about a week, were all confiscated. And exactly how that happened and how he got them back is the story I tell in the book. It's fascinating, not just because it's a great story in itself, not just because in my mind, and I think the mind of many, Almost Famous is a classic movie, a wonderful movie, and a absolute landmark in filmmaking, but it's just it's a story that's so revealing about Greg, about the nature of the relationship between a subject and a writer and all of the above. I couldn't have been more excited about the opportunity to tell that story.
Also want to make sure that I mention my friends in the real band Stillwater that the film's not based on, but there actually was a band out of Central Georgia, Stillwater, that was a Capricorn artist in 1970s and 80s, and Cameron Crowe in a 1975 interview referred to them as the Wet Tucker Brothers. He thought they were sort of bits and pieces of Wet Willie, Marshall Tucker, and Allman Brothers. So those guys are buddies, so I wanted to make sure I threw it in.
Yes, so that's fascinating, and I never have spoken to them, and it's fascinating, and I would love to talk to them because I always did wonder how they felt about their name being co-opted in that way. It could be viewed as an honor or it could be viewed as an insult. You might have more insight than me into how they felt about that.
Well, we won't drag this out in the interview, but briefly, the studio reached out to them before the film was released and asked them for permission. They asked for a copy of the script. They read it. The studio paid them some type of payment for agreeing to use the name Stillwater, and the rest, as they say, is history. But they were aware of it before the film came out.
Right.
And they had met Cameron Crowe back at some of the Capricorn events in Macon in the 70s, which, as you also cover in the book, also included presidential candidates and movers and shakers from every aspect of society, not only the music world.
Right. Absolutely legendary event.
Alan, thanks for joining us, and best of luck with the new book. Rock fans are absolutely going to love it. In this week's covers, we want to recommend a remake of Ringo Starr's 1970 non-album single, It Don't Come Easy. Supposedly, Starr had helped writing the song from George Harrison, but Harrison is not credited. He performed it at the Concerts for Bangladesh at Madison Square Gardens, and the song appears on the soundtrack and in the documentary film. In 2014, the New Jersey band Smithereens released an album of covers, and that song was included. Their version of It Don't Come Easy is a rocking one, and it's definitely worth checking out. Give it a listen. All right, well, we are very honored to have the incredible Jeff Carlisi with us today. Jeff, welcome to the Southern Voice Rock Show.
Well, thank you, Jim. With intros like that, I'll have to be on your show more often.
Absolutely. Well, you know, with some of the people that I get the privilege of interviewing, I kind of run low on adjectives I can use to describe them, because so many of you guys have just had careers that were iconic and the product of your work is timeless. That's a great testament to what you've done and your skill level.
Well, I appreciate it. And I think it's only been for a lot of us recently, for me, certainly, that recently, when I say recently, in the last 5 to 10 years or so, there's been an appreciation from younger people and a much broader spectrum of music fans and listeners for the music that we created, as well as a lot of the other bands. It's not unusual for someone to come up to me that's half my age and say, well, I love that song, or I love that record. What's really fun is when someone says, I took up playing guitar because of you. And I remember, you know, as a kid, scratching records and whatever, and listening to Clapton and Duane and everybody else that we grew up on in the 60s, learning your craft. So when you've been able to pass that on to someone else, and in a positive way, that's puts a big grin on your face.
I've hit a lot of concerts, and when I go see bands from what I call the golden era, you know, the latter half of the 70s and early part of the 80s, I'm always taken back at the high percentage of attendance from people that are 25 and younger. I mean, they are obviously brand new. Maybe they grew up with their parents playing it when they were kids, but they have a passion for this great rock and roll.
What's the old expression? It's not your father's Oldsmobile anymore. It's like the young kids today, their parents came from the rock and roll generation. They didn't come from the big band era, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, that was great music. My parents were very open to all kinds of music and really supported me. But the point is that it's okay to listen to your parents' music. And if you like it, and, you know, and again, that's why classic rock radio evolved, because there was a marketplace for it. And I remember we'd be going to Las Vegas to do a gig, and I'd tell the guys in the band, I said, you know, years from now, our fans that we're going to play for tonight are going to be older and going to Las Vegas for vacation. Guess what? We're going to still be playing for them. What do you think they're going to, just because they get to a certain age, they're going to switch the genre of music? No, of course not. That came true. You go to Las Vegas now, and you've got all these rock bands playing contemporary or classic or whatever. So the Beatles started it all. So, you know, if anybody doesn't like it, blame them.
There's still a lot of current versions of a lot of the great bands that are still out there. In Southern rock, you know, Molly Hatchet's still out there, the Outlaws, Lynyrd Skynyrd, 38, of course. Bands like the Scorpions, and you see them on stage, and they're all in their, a lot of them, or anyway, are in their 70s, and they're high-energy show like you're watching them 30 or 40 years ago.
Sure, yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think it's great because, number one, it's the music that lives forever, not the members of the band or collectively or individually. It's the music. And I think it's wonderful that they're keeping the music alive. The problem I have with some of those bands, as you well know, a lot of them don't even have one original member. And what people sometimes don't understand, like they'll say, I went and saw the Allman Brothers or whatever. They were great. And I said, well, that's great. They're phenomenal players. And I bet it was a great show. But you didn't see the Allman Brothers with Duane, Dickie, Greg, Barry in 1970 or 71. That's a whole different thing. You didn't see Lynyrd Skynyrd in its original lineup. And so many other bands, that 38 Special included. That's fine and well, but I try to let people know is that a band is made up of however many members, 3, 4, 5, 6 members. And there's a chemistry and an equation, basically, if you will. A plus B plus C equals something. And if you take any one of those variables out, whether a member passes away or leaves or quits, it changes the dynamic. And I look back at when we used to get together and start writing and rehearsing, all 6 members of 38 Special put their DNA into the music in their own way. as we were working on songs, as we were writing and what have you. So it made it unique. And we weren't necessarily a collection of the best musicians in the world by any means, but nobody could do what we did. And that goes for any other band out there with the original lineup. So like I said, it's not a bad thing. I'm not dragging anybody under the bus because it's a music that lasts forever. I salute the bands that are keeping it alive, but I'm very grateful that I got to see Jimi Hendrix live, that I got to see grow up with Skinner and see them in their original state, the Allman Brothers, Zeppelin, Mountain. There was something magical about those bands at that time. Maybe it's just nostalgia, who knows?
I do think that those of us that are still hitting concerts today, we sort of get a best of both worlds, given the circumstance that we can go see the current version of the band playing the songs that we love. But in most cases, we have live recordings that we can go back and visit the sound of the original band. It's not the same as seeing them live, of course, but we can be reminded of really the imprint that the original bands made as well.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
So you're speaking of DNA, you mentioned Duane Allman. Duane and Ronnie Van Zant, I would say, are the two iconic figures in Southern rock. And you were influenced by Duane, but you had a personal relationship with Ronnie.
Yeah, well, I mean, the guys from Skinner, I mean, even prior to when they were Skinner, they were the 1% and the other names they had. When we grew up in the 60s, there were various teen clubs that we would play and in different bands, and everybody kind of had a reputation. It was just kind of a small community in Jacksonville, so everybody knew each other. I had a band in 69 and 70, my senior year of high school, the last band before I went off to college, and it was called Sweet Rooster, and it included Donnie Van Zant, Kevin Elson, Ken Lyons, who was the original bass player in 38, was on the first record, and myself and the drummer was a guy named Bill Pelkey, who didn't pursue music as a career, but remained a friend. Anyway, through that band and with Donnie, we got even closer to Skinner and of course, Ronnie, and the whole Van Zant clan. When I went off to college in Atlanta, I went to Georgia Tech, and I was going to be the next Frank Lloyd Wright, studying architecture, obviously, and Skinner was just starting to come up to Atlanta to play some clubs. So my friends are in town, and I'm going out and going to the club to listen to him, hanging out with him over at the hotel. And I remember one night, Gary blew his amp up, and, man, can I borrow your Marshall? Yeah, sure. Brought the Marshall over to the club. It's a club called Finocchio's, which is a very, very famous for a lot of different reasons club in the Atlanta area. And then, so in 1973, Al Cooper had discovered him. He was living in Atlanta and would hang out at Finocchio's. And fast forwarding, he signs him to a deal with his Sounds of the South label, which was a subsidiary of MCA. And because of Al hanging out in Atlanta and getting into the music scene, he learned about not only the Atlanta Rhythm Section, but another band that he was going to produce called Mose Jones. And where are the studios? Well, there were probably two or three studios in Atlanta, but the Rhythm Section had their own studio called Studio One. And I would go out there and hang out and listen to not only Skinner record, making that first record, but also being invited out and sitting in on a session where Rodney Mills was producing Barry Bailey, one of my favorite guitar players of all time and one of my biggest influences and mentors. And just like, wow, I see how it's done now. Not really at the time thinking I'll be doing this one day. It was a little premature, but for a lot of reasons we can get into later on, the economy and everything else just kind of gets steered in a direction, fortunately. And as they say, the rest is history. Ronnie and I became very close. We were fans of the same types of music in the sense of the folk blues, i.e. Y. Cooter and some of the folk slide players of that time. Ronnie was one of the smartest people, just as far as common sense, streetwise, and just a really... I'll give you an example. The
you know, a lot of times they say, Ronnie Van Zant, what's his legacy? Barefooted, Confederate flag waving, whiskey drinking, street fighting, got sex. Okay, stop. Hold on. One of the farthest things from the truth. Yeah, I mean, there were all those stories, but Al Cooper invited me. I was still in college. I had a year to go. And he was putting Blues Project back together. And we had become friends. And he asked me if I would be in the band. Asked me to join Blues Project. And I was like, oh, man. I got 1 year of school to go. And how do I tell my parents I'm going to drop out of school and do this? And they probably would have said, yeah, whatever you think you want to do, son, just go ahead and do it. But it wasn't a fair question to ask them after they'd putting me through college. I was so stressed out. And I picked up the phone one night, probably about 11 p.m., and I called Ronnie. And he was up in Atlanta. They were at Studio One. And I told him the situation. And people say, yeah, did he tell you? Yeah, man, go out. Go rock and roll. Go party. Antithesis of what you would think. And he said, put myself in the place when I was listening to his words. He goes, let me tell you something. He said, you're getting something right now that I never had an opportunity to get. And I'm thinking, what's he talking about? He goes, that's an education. He said, nobody's fault except my own. He goes, you've got 1 year left. And he said, after that, you've got the rest of your life to do what you want to do. And he says, I know that you, knowing you, he says, I know you'll be the best you could possibly be at whatever it is that, it, you know, that is, whether it's in music or whether it's designing, whatever it is. But the point is, don't screw it up now. And I just, it was like this awakening. I was like, what's sage advice? And looking back now, he said, you tip your hat to Mr. Cooper, meaning say thanks a lot, Al, but I'll take the pass. Thanks anyway. And looking back, they did put Blues Project together. And after 3 or 4 months, it broke up. And where would I have been? I finished school, graduated, started 38 Special. And probably someone asked me one time, what's the best single piece of advice you ever got from anybody? That was it. That was it.
I guess that kind of reveals the genuine Ronnie Van Zant versus the public cultivated image.
Absolutely, without a doubt. His moral values. And again, the way he wrote songs, I would consider him a genius. Ed King one time told me, he goes, if you ever want to know Ronnie Van Zant, just take any six Skinner songs. Doesn't matter. Put them in a bag, mix them up, reach out, pick any six Skinner songs and listen to them, and you'll understand the man. And I thought that was so true. But that's why, you know, years later, when I had the opportunity to help Ronnie write Four Walls of Rayford, yeah, it was a very, very special moment and something I'll always be very, very proud of.
And it has stood the test of time.
Yeah, it has. I mean, when you go in and you do something, you're having fun. You're creating something. With certain songs, you know you got something special, or it might have a shot being a single or getting on the radio, whatever. But you're basically just doing what you do. I don't think either one of us had any idea that it would be such a, I don't know whether you want to call it a cult following or standing the test of time, but then being real pertinent to history in general and what the story was all about. It was special. And again, it was three of us in the studio. We had all sitting around playing. Ronnie always loved country music, and we had this, I can't remember, he had a great name for the band, but he wanted to put this kind of side project together, and it included some of Skinner and some of 38. Don Barnes and I both enjoyed playing country music and were big Jerry Reed fans and what have you, and Steve Brookins, our drummer, had a great feel for it, and there was Ronnie and I believe Alan and Billy. Anyway, we finished doing this recording at their studio down on Riverside, which is right next door to our rehearsal place, and yeah, you know, Ronnie said, you got to be anywhere? I said, no, what's up? He goes, I got this idea for a song I'd like you to work with me on. He started singing the lyrics, and he got about second verse, and he stopped for a second. And I said, what happened? I said, you forget the lyrics? And he goes, yeah, they'll come back to me. And I said, innocently but ignorantly, where's your notebook? Why don't you just get your notebook and look at the lyrics? And he looked at me like I was an alien that just landed from Jupiter. And he said, I don't write anything down. And that's when I realized, wow, I'm in some real company here. And anyway, I came back to him. And we went out. Everybody else had left. It was me and Ronnie and Kevin Nelson. And Kevin was engineering. And we went out, studio. He dropped a mic between us, sat on two stools opposite each other. And Gary's Dobro was there. And I picked that up. And I don't know, we did maybe five takes of it. Yeah, live, no, we didn't. If I screwed up, yeah, we just went ahead and started again, no punching in or anything. So I think it was about the fifth take, and that was it. And when that came out originally, I think it was on, after the plane crash, it was a compilation record, gold and platinum, or I think that was it, gold and platinum. Anyway, the song was on there, but Tom Dowd had come in and put some overdubs on it with Gary and Billy playing on it. And I was proud that the song was there, but they really, it missed the whole vibe and feel of what we did that night.
It was kind of a raw, bare bones recording, I would say. Is that fair?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was an instrument and two instruments, a voice and a dobro, but that's it. And it was as if, this might be an old cliche, but it's as if you were, you know, on some old front porch of some cabin out in Mississippi. That's the vibe that style of playing invoked. It wasn't genuine, it wasn't authentic. And then a few years later, some kid after a show, I think it was in Wichita, Kansas, he goes, man, thanks for Four Walls of Rayford. I said, yeah, I wish you could have heard the original version. No, that's what I'm talking about. And he finally convinced me that it had just come out on the box set. Then the song really started hitting home. So, yeah, cool story. And you just never know what's going to happen with something. But that's part of always remember and take with me. Not only that, but when I equate that with Ronnie and the advice that he gave me, I was definitely blessed to have walked the same grounds with him.
You mentioned a couple of different things there that I wanted to just kind of recap. And Rodney Mills, in our interview with him, shared the same thing about Ronnie just kind of standing off in the side of the room when the band was working on a song and writing the lyrics in his head and walking straight to the microphone, and then boom, out they come. And you also mentioned another important figure in Southern rock, and that's Kevin Elson. And Kevin, in addition to being a survivor of the 77 crash, was the guy that Rodney credits with being able to redirect the recording of the Street Survivors album in 77 and get it out of Criterion into Studio One. And he was an instrumental part of turning it into what it ended up being, which was a monster record.
Oh, absolutely. As we morphed into a different thing after I got out of school, continued with music, started 38 Special, but Kevin was working with Skinner, obviously, at the time. But he always had great ears. As they became more and more successful and made more and more records, we both agreed, this is opinion, if you will, but, and we agreed at the time that the best records that Skinner up to that time had made were records from Studio One that Al Kooper produced. For a lot of reasons. Al Kooper really understood that band better than anybody. I'm very excited that he's finally getting his due, and he's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, which is great. The sound of the studio, just, it was the perfect storm. The right producer, the right studio, the right environment being in the South. As they started going in different directions, second helping, that record, even as Alabama was recorded in Studio One, the rest of that record was recorded, I think, at the record plant out in L.A. But Al produced it, and it had the same kind of vibe. And then later on, with different producers and whatever, just didn't feel that going in the right direction or the same direction for the band. And partially it was the band, I guess. Who knows? And the producer, the studios, the whole thing. when Street Survivors came about, of course, Steve Gaines was in the band. And Kevin tells me that he went down because he was staying in Jacksonville at the time. I think he was working in their studio, Skinner's studio in Jacksonville. And he went down to hear some stuff and was disappointed in the way it was turning out and sounding. And I think Steve Gaines was one of the guys that just said, you know, I think you're right. And to convince them, because they were working with Tom Dowd at the time and they really liked Tom a lot, they weren't sure. And so I guess I remember Rodney telling me, and you would know more from the interview, they came up to Atlanta, I believe, with Artemis and recut the drum tracks and then brought them back down to Criteria so they could hear the difference. And that's when Rodney said, pack up, boys. We're going to Atlanta.
I thought that was just an incredible story, and it's a lot of good background on an album that's been a major component of our musical lives for those of us that are fans from that era.
Oh, absolutely. I remember going over to Alan Collins' house. He had the, I guess, probably test pressings or whatever, because I don't think the album was released until like a couple of days after the plane crash, if I'm not mistaken.
It was pretty close. But it was either a couple before or a couple after.
But I was over there and he was playing it for me and I was just like knocked out because, number one, the quality of the songwriting was amazing and the performances. And it was like this rebirth of the band. A lot of it, I think, probably due to Steve Gaines. It was that breath of fresh air or that shot of adrenaline or whatever. It made a real big difference. And the band was in top form. And that combined with going back to Studio One, and working with Rodney and Kevin, probably two people that really understood them better than anybody, especially Kevin, they made just a brilliant record. As you said, it's one of the greatest, and it'll be around long after we're gone. and that's the tragedy of it, too, is that who knows what would have happened with that band in that formation had they had a chance to tour with that record. I've heard people say they would have been the next Rolling Stones or whatever. Very possible. I mean, the three most frightening bands I've ever seen, again, this goes back to seeing the original formation, is Skinner, either with Ed King or with Steve Gaines playing, the original Allman Brothers, and Mountain with Leslie West and Felix Pappalardi. It was like, you just can't imagine how good this is, how powerful this is. So Skinner had that work ethic, and that all of a sudden now they're getting it back together, writing great songs, and taking themselves to the next level. Yeah, who knows? Who knows?
We'll be back next episode with more from Jeff Carlisi, his time with 38 Special, writing all their great hits, and so much more. For this week's Hidden Gem, we want to recommend the 1983 self-titled debut album from a band called Fastway. The band was made up of former members of Motorhead, UFO, and Humble Pie, and this is a rocking album. It went as high as number 31 on the United States charts, behind the strength of the single Say What You Will. The band has continued for years, but with a lot of lineup changes, the first album is the one you really want to hear, Fastway from 1983. Give it a listen. We want to thank everyone for listening, and we want to thank our guest, Alan Paul. Be sure to keep an eye out for his book on July 25th, and Jeff Carlisi, and we'll be back next week with more from Jeff. So until then, keep rocking.
Thanks for listening.